I am Dennis. I'm recovering alcoholic addict. By the grace of this program and my higher power, I have 8 years as of September 20th. And I couldn't have done it without Austin Recovery for sure. Because if I didn't go to Austin Recovery, I wouldn't be sober right now because I wouldn't have gone anywhere because I couldn't afford a treatment facility at the time. Hopefully he will watch the TV now. So if y'all hear background, it's a cartoon so that he's distracted because he likes to play with the computer. But my story is a little bit different than most people's because, yeah, I did have my first drink at 12, but I didn't drink again until I was 18. And then I very rarely ever drank because I didn't like the taste of alcohol. Imagine that. I grew up in Austin, born in California, grew up in Austin. Grayson, stop. Please, please. You can't play with that computer. My parents were divorced by the time I was one. I grew up in Austin with my grandparents. That was the only saving grace was the fact that I had stable grandparents that I could, so I had a stable home growing up. My dad was a very abusive mentally, physically, man growing up. The first time I ever heard the word fag or queer was from him. And I was about 4 or 5 years old. I didn't even know what that word was yet. And, he got so bad that my mother broke a cast iron skillet across his head for hitting me one time. And that's pretty hard to do. And he divorced his second wife by the time I was 5, and so I was back at my grandparents again. But I had a really good childhood with all intents and purposes. Get mad at me. This is not easy, okay? I'm so sorry, guys. Stop. Don't unplug the computer. He wants to unplug it. Thank God I have battery. But my actual drug use, I mean, I grew up and very anti-drug, very anti against drugs, against selling them, against everything. I didn't allow it in my house when I was growing up, when I turned 18 and 19, was living on my own. And so I thought I was going to be that one person that never did a drug, you know, that was just going to go on. It's going to be me and my twin sister. We're going to be the sober ones in our family. Or the normies. Because my alcoholism and drug addiction runs rampant in my family, on my dad's side especially. So I thought I was going to be, you know, the good little boy and not do anything. I've tried it. I've tried coke. I tried them all up until, you know, all that was available when I was in my 20s. And, you know, coke, pot, and pot I can eat on my own. I can laugh and eat on my own. Coke, I can be paranoid on my own. I don't need coke to make me paranoid. So it wasn't until I graduated, and my grandmother died when I was 18, and that was the first big hit to, I was mad at her for years because she was the one person besides my grandfather that I looked up to that I knew that was safe, that no matter what I did, I was in good hands, no matter what happened, you know. And then she died of cancer in 2000, when I was 18 years old, before I even graduated high school. I was very fortunate. I didn't use that excuse to drink and do drugs. I don't know why, because I was angry at her for dying. That was the whole thing. I was angry for dying. So a little more on my dad. My graduation, he showed up for my graduation, but he did. He was such in a hurry and such an impatient person. He didn't even get to walk. He was walking out the door as I was walking across the stage. And to this day, he swears he saw the whole thing, but yet he can't describe anything of it. So I was the person that everybody looked to. I was the designated driver. I was, you know, because I didn't want to drink, but, in my 20s, I did get a little bit into the coke a little bit, but it was one of those things that where I could stop, you know, I use it for the weekend and then stop and not do it for another 6 months to a year or whatever. At the age of 25, most of my friends already know this, I was diagnosed with HIV. I was 25 at the time. I've shared that with most everybody because of the fact is I used to teach the class at Austin Recovery. So I was the person that all my friends looked up to and asked questions about that. So that was good. It wasn't until I moved to Houston in 1999, I moved to Houston and I moved to Houston for a man, for a relationship. Don't ever move to another city for a relationship. I got there 6 months into, stop it, Grayson. 6 months into our relationship, he came up to me after I sold my house here in Austin, sold my business, everything in Austin to move to Houston. He told me he didn't want to be in a relationship. And so I needed to find, you know, he wanted me to move back to Austin. I told him, no, I'm not moving back to Austin. I like it in Houston. I want to stay in Houston. And then I ended up getting involved with a group of people that were doing ecstasy. Everybody knew that I didn't do drugs and stuff like that, but they would always ask me every once in a while. And then one day I went to a circuit party is what they call it. The gays called it circuit party. Y'all called it raves. Okay. And everybody was just having a good time. And I'm like, you know what? I want to see what is so exciting about ecstasy. You know, what is so much fun about it? So I convinced my friends, it took me a while to convince them, but I convinced them to give me a pill and they only gave me a half. And it didn't do anything, or at least I thought it didn't do anything. It just hadn't kicked in yet, but I was being impatient. So behind my friend's back, I found somebody and bought another one. And so I took one and a half on my first time. Y'all think I'm hyper and crazy moving now in regular life? They said that I was doing circles around the club and I would stop each group and just like, I was talking so fast that they could barely understand what I was saying. And then I'd just take off and then I'd stop at the next group. I had so much fun that night. So that was my gateway drug was ecstasy. So I got to where I'd do it on the weekends. I worked at a bar at the time too. Worked for JR's of all bars in Houston. I had some friends stay the night one night, and I was saving money to buy a house, to buy my house in Houston, because I bought a house in Houston. And like a fool, I kept cash at home. I was putting it in the big jar and just saving the tips from my bartending job. I got drunk that night. And they had to drive me home. And so they drove me home. And when I woke up in the morning, they were gone and all my money was gone. to the tune of about $5,000, my down payment for my house. And so I was talking to a friend of mine, a client, because I was a very successful hairdresser in Houston, very successful. I got voted gayest and greatest one year from the Houston Chronicle. I was so distraught about the money coming up. I was talking to a friend of mine. He goes, "Well, you know, I'm a supplier for ecstasy." I'm like, "You are?" He goes, "Yeah, I'll sell them to you for this much, and you can sell them at the bar for this much, and you can make your money back in no time." And that pretty much started me on selling drugs, you know, and then it got to be every single weekend I was doing them. And then I had to figure out something to keep me up on Tuesday through Friday when I go to work. So guess what drug came in play for that one? Good old methamphetamines. And so I started doing ecstasy on the weekends and K, ketamine and G and all that stuff. And then I would do meth so that I could stay up and go to work as a hairdresser. And I did that and successfully for about 2 years. One of my stipulations was I was never going to sell out of my store. Was never going to, because I owned my own salon in Houston. I was never going to let those two businesses intermingle. And it ended, excuse me, in about 2 years into it, I was so far deep, I ended up doing meth every day, because I that was my drug of choice. That ended up being my crutch, my Heelys. Whatever you want to call it. Even after being pulled over doing 110 through Columbus, through 71 and 10, you don't ever do over the speed limit in that area. They will pull you over in a heartbeat. And I was doing 110. The cop pulls me over and he goes, "You know how fast you're?" He goes, "You were doing 90. What I really wanted to tell him was I was doing 110 when I saw you. But I had to, so he smelled pot in my house, in my car. He said, "I smell pot." I said, "I don't have any." He goes, "Well," me being the naive person then, not knowing that you can say no to search and this, that, and other, I let them search my car. And they found, I think it was an 8-ball of meth, 13 pills of ecstasy and some G, some coke. Basically, it was a party in the car. So they arrested me, impounded my car. When they impounded my car, they searched it again once it was impounded, and they found the money that I had hidden in the car that was to pay my rent. It was literally not drug money. It was literally my rent money. But because I had that much drugs on me, they assumed that I was selling them, so they kept the money. I never got that back. First time ever being in trouble, the cop goes, "Well, just be honest with us, and we'll go easy on you, and just be honest." So I was 100% honest. I said, "This is for my use. And, me and some friends bought it to do it together. And I'm the one that's bringing it home." I'm lucky that they didn't get me in different districts, because they were looking for all kinds of stuff to get me. They tried to get me for manufacturing, for distributing. But in the long run, I got two charges for the meth and the coke, and they dropped the other two drugs. Gave me 7 years probation. 7 years probation was a long time for. I stayed sober for about a year. Well, actually, no, I didn't. I used right up until I got sentenced. Matter of fact, I missed court one day because I was so high. We passed out at the hotel 3 miles from the courthouse. So I got put on probation. My dad put up the bond money when I got arrested. And eventually I got in trouble and lost his bond money, and he lost his tractor for his property. This was my adopted dad. So he was mad at me for that for a long time. And then I ended up going back to Houston and doing my probation, starting my probation. And I had there was a time about a year after, I think I made a year on probation, and then I started using again. And there was a time when my friends found me wandering Montrose, screaming, like, you know, the homeless people on the street screaming at themselves. Craziness. That's what I was doing. And so my friends caught me, and they said, let's go back to your, because I wasn't even near home. I was at my shop. And they said, let's go back to the shop. And I finally got back to the shop, and everybody left. I locked the doors, and I broke down on my hands and knees, crying and telling God, please, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to use. I don't want to sell. I don't want nothing to do with drugs. I can't do this anymore. And, I mean, pounding my fist on this concrete floor. And I got in my car and went home that night. And the next day, I told all my friends, I'm not doing this anymore. Don't ask me. Don't call me for drugs. I'm not doing this. I can't do it. A couple days into it, my friend goes, my boyfriend got arrested, and then you get the car out of impound, and I don't have the money, and da da da. And I said, no, I can't do anything for you. And then, you know, you just beg and beg. And, you know, I'm Mr. I want to help everybody. So stop, Grayson. No. So I said, okay, I'll get an 8-ball. I'll sell it. And then we'll get the car back out. Well, in the process, we found out that you had to have certain forms to get the car out. So my bright idea is, like, you've got a signature on one piece of paper, right? He goes, yeah. I said, well, I can fix this. We can forge it. Now, that's not me. I'm not a forger. I can't even write my own name. So this guy came knocking at my door, because we were at the shop doing this. And I knew he was kind of sketchy, and I kept telling him, no, no. And then finally, I said, fine, come and get your 50. And he came and got a 50. He left. And about 30 minutes later, he's texting me again, wanting some more. No, sir. And I said, okay, fine, come to the door, I'll get you. And he brought the cops with him. They literally almost busted down the door of my salon. Where my salon sat, you could, the bars in Montrose could see the front door of my salon. So everybody knew what was going down, because there was like 10 cop cars, marked and unmarked. And so they searched the salon, you know, they found, they marked the bill. So they found the bill, so they knew that it was from me, you know, that I'm the one that sold it. But they hadn't found any product on me. They literally jerked me out of the salon, slammed me against the wall. And in my shop, there's a planter and a wall. And I was between the planter and the wall. And I threw the drugs out of my pocket. I was in the clear, because nobody saw me. But when he pulled me back in, I hit the mailbox, and he thought I threw, because when my arm went like that, when I hit the mailbox. So he searched for like 30 minutes to find that baggie. So I went to jail that time, and got a 2-year sentence in Houston. They sent me back to Columbus, and I got a 3-year sentence. No, I got a 3-year in Houston and a 5 in Columbus. And before I even left Columbus, I already knew I was going to be out in 6 months, because I got my parole answer before I even got into TDCJ. I was the lucky one. Every place I ended up, my paper would get screwed up and I would end up staying longer than I was supposed to. I was supposed to stay at LeBlanc for 6 months. I ended up staying 9 months. I ended up staying in prison a total of 17 months. And so I get out, I get on parole, and I'm doing really good. And I relapsed, and I did it one time, and my parole officer found out, and she said, okay, I'm going to let you have a slide in this one. And then I took a pain pill, Tylenol 3, with codeine. I didn't realize that what it was I knew I was taking something for a headache, but I didn't realize I was going to get in trouble for it. So I went into P-test, and they caught me with codeine in my system, and they said, she goes, you know what, Dennis, I know you're better than this, so I'm going to send you to prison. I'm going to send you to ISF. So they revoked my parole and sent me to ISF. And in between the time that I got in trouble with the coding and the time I had to turn myself in, I had already gone balls to the walls. I was doing meth again every day, selling it. I didn't even have a place to live. I literally lived in my car, or I would sell enough drugs or work at a restaurant, worked at Denny's enough, because I got in so much trouble in Houston that no salon would ever hire me because they my back of what they've heard. And that hurt because, you know, as most of my friends know, I love doing hair. I still do it today, even though I don't have a shop. I don't work at it anymore as a career. It's for fun for me. After that, I pretty much got out of ISF, totaled my car, got back on, you know, I was back on drugs. I wasn't even off drugs that long. And, I called my mom and I told my mom, I says, they stole my car. They stole my keys. They stole my wallet. They stole my cell phone, everything. And she goes, well, come home. I says, I can't, mom. I don't have a car. I don't have any way there. So between her, my grandmother and my adopted dad, they bought me a $1,500 Grand Am. And I took everything from what little I had at the time, which was, I was a queen size bed that I put in storage. I put it on the top of my car and drove down the highway to go put it back in storage. So that was pretty funny. There's a black Grand Am that's going down 59 with a sleigh bed. I mean, it was nice. It was a wood sleigh bed going down 59 with the mattress and everything. Everything's on there. Got in the car and I couldn't leave Houston until my parole got transferred. Well, the lady that I had, the second parole officer, screwed up all my paperwork. See, I'm the one that if it's going to happen, they're going to screw up the paperwork. Because I was supposed to be in ISF for 3, I was there for 6. And I was supposed to be able to be in Austin in a month. I ended up being in Austin. And my mom just told me, drive, come home. And you can just drive to Houston every week. You've got your car now. And so that's what I did. I lied to my parole officer and told her that I was still living in Houston, but I drove to Houston every week to meet with her because I was on every week meeting with her. Finally they got my paperwork straightened out. I ended up getting to stay with my grandmother, my step-grandmother. And I was looking for a job, and I found a job at what they called Midtown Spa, which was a bathhouse for the gays, you know, party house. And I should have never taken that job because within 2 months, I was using again. Because that's all that goes on there is drugs and sex. I left there one night. I had just purchased them, and it was, you know, in my backpack, and I was in the car, and I was doing, the cop said I was doing 90 in that Grand Am, 90 down I-35, weaving in and out of traffic. you know, it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I was tired. I wanted to go home. And they pulled me over and they said that they followed me from downtown to, I think it was William Cannon almost, before they actually stopped me. And luckily I hadn't done anything before that, that night. And I get out and I'm talking to the cop and, you know, I give him my driver's license and one of the few times in my drug addiction, I actually had a license. Gave him my driver's license and explained to him that, you know, I just got off work. I'm coming home. It's late. I'm tired. I didn't realize I was doing that fast. And I says, I'm on parole. I laid it all out in line, you know, and I guess he took pity on me because he checked my license and he came back clear and he said, well, just slow down and go home. So that's what I did. And then I moved out of my grandmother's house because I didn't want to do the drugs in her house. I did not want to disrespect her by doing that. Never would. So I ended up moving in with a friend of mine and we got an apartment and I stayed clean for a couple. I didn't do a whole lot of drugs at that time for a long time, but within months of living on my own with no responsibilities but to pay my bills, I didn't have to hide it anymore. I could do what I wanted to because, no, honey, no, baby. So I was back running and gunning again. And say hi. At that time, I got to, I got really bad again. I was always really good at selling it. I was always really good at selling it. I never had a relationship long enough because of the drug use. What do you want, baby? Here, have the phone. I ended up moving into an apartment by myself and let's see, where was I? One of the main things is I've always had very good jobs in the salon industry. I always ended up being manager within a couple months. So I was manager of one store and my boss says that they're not going to give me a bigger store until I can prove that I can make money at a store. So, which I can't. I can sell hair like there's no tomorrow. I'm sorry. I'm not bragging on myself. I'm just telling the truth. So I got really bad. And then, I'm trying to place. Okay. So I ended up getting so bad that I wanted to get some help. So I reached out to Integral Care through CARE program and asked them to help me get into drug rehab. And that's when I heard about Austin Recovery. And I said, great. I don't have to go anywhere because it's right down the street from my mama's house. That's when we had three locations. It was October 2011. We had the Lodge, Cross Park, and the Ranch. And I was at the Lodge, Slaughter and Brody area. And I did my 30-day program. And the guy I was dating, it was supposed to work out. The guy I was dating was supposed to, as soon as I finished treatment, he was supposed to go to treatment. And that didn't happen. He basically brought another person into my house and had a relationship with them while I was gone. And then whenever I would leave for work after I got back, he had other people over. So I ended up having to lose that relationship. My grandmother, my biological grandmother died that New Year's Eve of 2011, 2012, right? And my boyfriend at the time kept accusing me of using, so I finally said, F it, and I'm going to just go use. And so I stayed sober for 3 months after Austin Recovery. But I can guarantee, I can tell you this, that every time I used, I had a little recovery in my head going, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? So I got back from California, broke up with that relationship. Yeah, I was in two abusive relationships with drugs. I won't tell their names because one of them's in the rooms and I'm so proud of him. I was living off a breaker off 35, and my house became a really hot spot. It was funny too because the cops had a speed trap right across the street from where my house was, my duplex. So every time somebody would come over, they go, "Can we wait inside for a little while? There's a cop out there." I'm like, "Oh yeah, he wants speeders. He doesn't want nothing else." And so, eventually, I got kicked out of that place, and in the process, I did get my promotion. They didn't know I had gotten back on drugs because my boss. I told my boss I had a problem, and I was going. And he said, "Fine, you can go. You got your job when you come back." And that Christmas before I relapsed, the store made $23,000 in that 1 month. And before that, December's were $10,000, $11,000. So I doubled their income, doubled their sales. So they went ahead and gave me the new store. And boy, if those stores could talk, I'd be in a lot of trouble. Because I did a lot of drugs in the back room in the office. That was my hiding place when I didn't want to be at home or I didn't want to be around other people. I'd go hide in my office or hide in the back room with all the doors locked of the salon. Thank God they didn't have cameras. eventually, I realized that I needed to figure something out, but I still wasn't ready. So in, I think it was July of that year of 2012, I got pulled over. I was turning into a parking lot and a cop was coming out of the parking lot. And I guess somebody had called the cops on my vehicle saying that I was selling drugs because the cops told me. That's why they stopped me. And so I told them that it was in my briefcase. I wasn't going to lie. It was my higher power, God, doing something that I couldn't do. I was going to have to go down again. I was going to have to get arrested again. By the way, I was already off parole when I got this last charge. What is that? So I got arrested and most meth heads are angry and cussing and violent and, when they're high and stuff. I believe me, I was high. When the cops pulled me over and they searched everything, I had a conversation with the cops. I was laughing with the cops. We were telling jokes back and forth. I was explaining what's going on. And so, and they busted magazine you know how they have the articles? I was a fourth page article. The happiest meth head was the name of the article. Because I was laughing and carrying on with the cops. So I was went to court every month. They had court for me. I had to go to court every month. And then like the second or third time I showed up to court, my attorney, which was court appointed this time, told me, he goes, "You do realize that they can test you at any given time." "No, sir, I didn't." He goes, "Yes, you can get tested at any time. I'd advise you to remember that." He didn't come out and tell me he knew I was high, but he knew. And that's why he told me that. And it was after that that I finally decided that I don't want to live this life anymore. And I had been staying in touch with the alumni. I'd show up to the alumni high as a kite. I mean, riding a scooter, a moped, high as a kite, pull up in to a meeting. And if it wasn't for, that case went on for 9 months, and they finally, the judge says, they hadn't indicted you yet, so we're going to go ahead and get the charges dropped. So they dropped the charges, but they told me that we reserve the right that if the lab results come back and we decide to prosecute, we can. I'm like, I don't care. Just get me out of here. I don't care anymore. Just let me go. So I got out, left court, and never looked back on the drugs again. And I got really engrossed in my home group, CMA, Turning Point, and the alumni. I mean, I was the Will was the Will and one other lady were and Jeff were the alumni leads, like Chris is. And I was like their second right hand man. Like if there was no pandemic, Chris, I'd be there right beside your side. Because that's the alumni I am. And I think you know that. So I got really engrossed into the alumni and really turned around. The first year of my sobriety, I lived out in Manor. I bought a $900 BMW that was wrecked in the front, but it ran and drove, and it got me back and forth to Austin. I did that for a year. And then moved into town and got my own apartment in town. And it was just, you know, my landlord in Manor had me let somebody else move in, and that guy started doing drugs and stuff. And I said, "I'm not doing this. I'm not going to live with a drug addict." And she goes, "Well, then you can leave." And I'm like, "Okay, then I'm going to leave." I got in my car, packed all my stuff, and I left. I said, I don't have to live like this anymore. My higher power says I don't have to live like this anymore. So I'm not going to. Stayed with a friend for a month, and then we got a duplex together. Lost my job 1 year into my sobriety, almost to the date of my sobriety. I lost my job with TGF as a manager. And that's when I opened up my own. And about 6 months after I opened up my own, so from the beginning of my sobriety, when I started, when I lived out in Manor, I started doing haircuts for the ranch. Every weekend, or every other weekend, and it ended up being almost every weekend, cutting hair for the women and then the men, or the men and then the women. And I was there one Sunday cutting hair, and they were looking for an RCS, and I said, "I want to apply." And I had a lot of the staff already on my side, plus Will Miley, you know, Will and I got along great. So I got the job, and it was more than I ever imagined job wise. I wasn't making much money, but I was so, because when I was in the salon industry, I was making between $60,000 and $70,000. I was making $11 an hour working overnight RCS. And I was more happier than I had ever been in my life before that. Austin Recovery gave me the life that I needed, not the life that I wanted, the life that I needed. I got to help people. I got to teach people. It was an amazing experience. And I was perfectly content with being an RCS for the rest of my time there. But when they reorganized one time, they said, well, we needed a driver. And when Will goes, go get your driver's license because we know you don't have it right now because you're going to be a driver. So you need your driver's license. So my first 3 months as a driver, I was on occupational license. And so just FYI, a lot of y'all, I got to y'all rode in a car with occupational license driver. And I quit Austin Recovery because I got mad at a certain staff member and went to work for somewhere else. I didn't like it. So I came back to Austin Recovery. I was told not to apply for any other jobs at Austin Recovery until at least a year. So on my year anniversary, I asked Laura, can I apply for the case manager position? She goes, yes. And that's when I became a case manager. And I owe everything today to my sobriety, to Austin Recovery. I mean, I'm 53 years old. I own my own home. I have a new car. I have a great career, a new career. And I get to foster a little boy that I would never have thought I would be able to do because of being a single gay male. You okay, Grayson? He just fell. And I'm honored to be able to do all this stuff. This is a life that I would have never imagined. And if you don't think that the sobriety is worth it or that you can have fun in sobriety, come talk to me. I'll show you because I have a blast. I just got back. Me and Grayson just got back from a camping trip at Rainbow Ranch with a bunch of sober LGBT community people. You know, we had a bonfire meeting every night. You know, it was great. It was fun. Yes, and we social distanced. But I get to do things like that now. I get to take my camper and go camping, and I get to hug on my puppies, and the only thing that I miss right now is being with y'all. That's the part that hurts the most. Is I want to be with y'all. I'd rather be in Troll Hall speaking to y'all in person. And I love all of y'all, and thank you for letting me tell my story tonight.
Thank you, Dennis.
Wow, that was amazing. Dennis, you're awesome. Dennis. We love you.
I'm so happy you. That you are looking after that little boy. I love that little boy, too.
Me, too. He's just incredible.